This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Last week, the Supreme Court met to hear arguments for and against two federal vaccine mandates. To learn more about how it's going, we're joined by Brian Dean Abramson, adjunct professor of vaccine law at Florida International University College of Law. Welcome back, Brian. It's great to have you with us.
It is a pleasure to be back.
What did the Supreme Court discuss during hearings last Friday? If you can get us up to speed for those of us who may not have been following this detail by detail.
Well, last November, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA, and the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, CMS, simultaneously, or basically at the same time, instituted vaccination mandates that the Biden administration had announced were going to be instituted. The OSHA mandate affected all companies with more than 100 employees, and this was calculated sort of liberally, all employees, whether they're part-time or full-time, didn't matter whether they were working from home. And the CMS mandate affects all recipients of Medicare and Medicaid funds. They operate a little bit differently. The OSHA mandate requires that companies falling under that coverage with 100 or more employees either have a vaccination mandate for their employees or have weekly testing of unvaccinated employees, which can be somewhat pricey and therefore pushes those companies towards having a vaccination mandate. Whereas the CMS mandate did not have an option for testing at all. It just says that any entity that is a recipient of Medicare and Medicaid dollars has to have a policy in place to vaccinate its employees, to require their vaccination.
Comes to the two hearings, was one just for OSHA and one for the CMS mandate?
That is correct. So the OSHA mandate went through a bit of a circus where it was initially blocked by a court of the United States, by the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. A panel of judges decided that it was unconstitutional or statutorily unsupportable. And that was due to kind of a forum shopping exercise where people try and file cases in a circuit that they think will be amenable to what they're trying to achieve. In order to prevent that, the courts have a process where they have a lottery to decide which circuit is going to hear all of the cases relating to that matter. It ended up being put in the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. The Sixth Circuit overturned the Fifth Circuit, lifted the stay that the Fifth Circuit had imposed. And that was what went to the Supreme Court with respect to the OSHA mandate. The CMS mandate was in a very different position. You have courts that have put a stay on the CMS mandate in 25 states. So about half the country is currently stayed for the CMS mandate for Medicare and Medicaid dollars, and half the country is not. And it's sort of untenable that a law is considered to be permissible in half the country and impermissible in the other half. So the Supreme Court had a separate hearing on that. They had the hearings back to back. With the first hearing, because the Sixth Circuit lifted the stay, you have state governments that are plaintiffs in that case that went first and argued their case as to why the stay should be reimposed. With the CMS matter, the Biden administration went first, arguing that the stays that have been imposed should be lifted for that. And the two mandates come from very different places. They come from different sets of federal powers. The OSHA mandate is derived from the Interstate Commerce Clause, from the ability of Congress to regulate things that happen in interstate commerce to ensure its flow. And there's an idea that worker safety has to be maintained to avoid certain costs being imposed on interstate commerce. So OSHA proceeded under that authority, whereas the CMS mandate is about Medicare and Medicaid funds being spent. It's the government saying, this is our money, these Medicare and Medicaid dollars. We're deciding how to spend them, and we're deciding that we're not going to spend them on hospitals and institutions that don't have vaccination mandates in place. So the court had two very different issues to kind of grapple with, and they had a fairly lengthy hearing for each one.
I just want to clarify for those of us who may have heard some of these terms but may not be totally familiar, when you're mentioning that there was a stay for some of these mandates, or I don't know if that's correct to say, what does that mean necessarily?
Well, when a court puts a stay on something, that means that the agency that has introduced this rule is prevented from carrying it out. So the OSHA mandate, when it was stayed, OSHA was prohibited from carrying out anything to do with the mandate. It couldn't investigate companies or fine companies that weren't conforming with the mandate. And that has been the case up until yesterday. Because the stay was lifted in the Sixth Circuit and the Supreme Court hasn't spoken to it yet, technically the OSHA mandate is now in effect. However, that mandate doesn't have any consequences until February 9th. That is the renewed schedule or revised schedule of when companies would actually have to begin testing unvaccinated employees. With the CMS stay, that would basically be a prohibition on the government withholding Medicare or Medicaid dollars from hospitals that are not conforming with the mandate required by CMS. Now, it's worth noting that most hospitals are conforming, even in states where that stay has been put in place. It is state governments and state attorneys general who have objected to the CMS mandate. And that was something that the court actually pointed out in oral argument, that we have some state government officials who are here, but very few hospitals or other private recipients of Medicare and Medicaid dollars who are contesting the CMS regulation.
Does that show that for healthcare versus, I guess, the political arena, that healthcare workers do want to see these types of mandates?
By and large, that is definitely the case. There have been certainly instances of the disease spreading through healthcare venues. Everybody wants to avoid that. Within the healthcare industry, there are very high compliance rates. They're in the high 90%. And there are, with respect to both of the mandates, exceptions provided for people who have medical objections or religious objections to vaccination. And most of the people who are not vaccinated at this point fall into one of those buckets of having asserted a religious or medical basis for not being vaccinated. There are very, very few people who are in the position of saying, you know what, I don't have a medical objection. I don't have a religious objection. I just don't want to be vaccinated. And employers are at liberty to terminate those people if they're in violation of a mandate that has been either passed down by the employer or one that has been imposed by the government, whether it's state or federal government, and that employers are required to comply with.
It's interesting. I'm thinking just I live in a high rise, and we recently got a note from our management company that they will not service people's apartments unless they're vaccinated, and their employees have to be vaccinated or tested once a week or they'll be let go. And I thought that was a really interesting step to take, considering that this stuff is still kind of being discussed.
Well, you know, it's interesting that the OSHA mandate only applies to businesses with more than 100 employees, but there are a tremendous number of private businesses, irrespective of the number of employees, who are on their own accord imposing vaccination mandates. And this is partly due to concerns about potential liability. Certainly in your building, the building management doesn't want to be liable for sending an employee into an apartment where that employee becomes sick and then might have a cause of action against the building. And at the same time, they certainly don't want to send an unvaccinated employee into an apartment where that employee causes the residents to become sick. So the mandates that have been put in place are kind of designed to reach the most recalcitrant people who aren't interested in or willing to get vaccinated. But there's a tremendous amount of activity in the private sector where these sorts of mandates have been imposed outside of anything that government is requiring, just as a matter of employers covering their own bases.
Mm-hmm. And with regards to the Supreme Court hearings, was there anything unusual about these two hearings or interesting? Is this something that's never happened before?
Procedurally, it's very rare to have a hearing at this point in a case. Usually when the Supreme Court hears a case, it's something that has been argued and decided at a district court level and then appealed to a court of appeals and then appealed to the Supreme Court. And there's sort of a final determination on the law and the court is being called upon to consider that. When they are seeking a stay, when parties are seeking a stay so that the law doesn't take effect until those substantive proceedings happen, usually the Supreme Court just has a single justice who is responsible for each circuit, and that justice has this sort of authority to decide whether a stay is going to be granted for that circuit pending Supreme Court action. Rarely they'll poll the court, and the justice will determine if there's a majority on the court that opposes or supports that stay. But having an actual hearing where there is oral argument, where the parties are represented and the justices are asking questions at this point in the case is very unusual. It's only happened a handful of times in the history of the court.
Do you think these two mandates have chances of avoiding a stay?
I think the mandates come from very different positions. And based on the tenor of the argument before the court and what the justices seem to be interested in and where they sort of projected their concerns were, there is a fairly widespread agreement that it's likely that the OSHA mandate will be stayed, that there will be a majority of justices who think that OSHA has exceeded their power. And there are some different possible outcomes of that. Some justices may say that this is just up beyond what the Constitution would provide for them, while others may say that they have the power to do this, but the way they went about it, issuing an emergency temporary standard that had to meet certain special requirements to be issued very quickly without any notice and comment from the public, that they went about it the wrong way, or that the standard itself has issued with this seemingly arbitrary cutoff of 100 or more employees, not taking into account the fact that some employers have that many employees, but most of them work from home, while other employers have maybe somewhat fewer employees, but they're all working together on a factory floor. There are different issues that justices can pick as the basis for saying, well, this should be stayed. And we may have multiple opinions with respect to the OSHA mandate coming out with different rationales for why it should be stayed. And that can be important because if it's an issue with the structure of how OSHA came out with it, that may be something that can be fixed.
Well, we'll be back after a quick break. We're talking about the recent Supreme Court hearings on vaccine mandates. And when we come back, we'll look into some of the arguments for or against these mandates. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're talking about recent Supreme Court hearings on two federal vaccine mandates. The Supreme Court met to hear arguments for and against the two federal vaccine mandates. With us is Brian Dean Abramson, adjunct professor of vaccine law at Florida International University College of Law. Brian, before the break, we were kind of touching upon some of the pros and cons that might be brought up for these mandates. Have you heard specific arguments for and then against these mandates?
Yes. And the arguments primarily are based on the degree of the danger to society. That is a major point that the court addressed. Some of the justices, particularly Justice Breyer, were very concerned about the fact that we have large numbers of people currently being hospitalized or becoming infected with COVID, much larger numbers than we actually had at the time that the OSHA mandate was first announced due to the Omicron variant. While some of the justices who are skeptical of the mandates have pointed out that the mandates aren't really for the protection of people who are already vaccinated, which a substantial majority of the workforce is, they're for the protection of people who largely choose not to be vaccinated and therefore are in a position of sort of making the choice as to whether or not they want to have that protection. And there's a question of whether those people are in the sort of grave danger that the government contemplates or that the statute that allows OSHA to institute an emergency measure contemplates. You know, the statute requires that there be a grave danger, that it be a new threat, and that the action taken by OSHA be necessary to combat that and that it be feasible economically. And all of those are points that have been challenged with respect to OSHA's mandate.
There's a lot to consider, I think, with all of these things, if you really try to look at it from so many different angles. But I wonder, you know, is there anything the federal government could do legally that would enforce private companies to require, for example, vaccinations for their employers? Or is there a separate thing between like a private company versus a government company?
Well, you know, that is the question ultimately that the court is being called upon to resolve. Historically, when there have been epidemics and pandemics, state governments have been the entities that have stepped up and required vaccination and have imposed various kinds of penalties for non-vaccination. So this is the first time that the federal government has attempted to use OSHA as a vehicle through which to mandate vaccination in the workforce. And that's why we're at the point of having a controversy, because it's been discussed before. Is this something that the federal government has the power to do? But it's not something that we really know that they do. There's a 1905 precedent, Jacobson v. Massachusetts, which says that the state government does have the power constitutionally to mandate vaccination of the population. And recently, some people have begun looking at Jacobson not necessarily as an empowering case, but as a limiting case with respect to the federal government, saying it gave the states this power, therefore the federal government doesn't have it. That may be reading a bit much into what Jacobson intended, but certainly in order for the federal government to be able to act, there has to be a source of power that can be found in the Constitution. And in order for an agency to act, there has to be a source of power that can be found in a federal statute that empowers that agency. And the questions exist: is it constitutional for the federal government at some level to mandate vaccination for people who aren't directly under its control, like the military? And do the statutes that enable OSHA to carry out its operations and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to carry out their operations enable these respective agencies to impose a vaccination mandate on people who are under their coverage?
Is there worry at all that you mentioned this Jacobson versus Massachusetts kind of setting some precedent? Is there worry that if something were to pass in that similar vein this year, let's say, it could set precedent in the future for folks to be forced to vaccinate against any and everything that comes out?
That is also one of the concerns that the Supreme Court raised, not so much in terms of the precedent that it would set, but in terms of the question with respect to COVID-19, is this really a temporary measure? Is this really a temporary measure directed towards this emergency that is going to kind of evaporate once there is no longer an emergency? And how do we decide when the emergency is over? There's certainly every indication that COVID is not ever going to go away entirely. It will ideally or hopefully become something that is manageable, like the flu. And of course, we deal with influenza by having an annual flu shot. There are a lot of people who are concerned that, well, if we institute this as an emergency measure, we're going to end up having a regime where the government requires everyone to have a flu shot every year. Certainly, there are industries that do require that. A lot of hospitals require their employees to do that, but not a general industry, not in manufacturing, for example. So the justices did express a concern that, are we really talking about a temporary measure, or how do we know that this is going to go away at some point in the future, that we're not giving the government a permanent power to dictate this aspect of people's lives? And that is a legitimate concern. There certainly need to be constraints. I think OSHA can point to the fact that they had a temporary emergency measure for just the healthcare industry that expired after 6 months, as these emergency temporary measures do, and that on its expiration, they said, well, we can't enforce this anymore, and they didn't try to renew it or continue enforcing it. But I don't know that that is something that will persuade justices who are concerned that if we establish this as a federal power, it will just be something that endures without any limitation or any endpoint.
If you're listening live and have any questions or comments on our topic today, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Brian Dean Abramson, adjunct professor of vaccine law at Florida International University College of Law. Brian, one thing that I've been wondering too is, How are these things, you mentioned something about enforcement, how are these things going to be enforced if they do pass?
That is another, that's another issue that I think a lot of people haven't talked about. And the fact of the matter is, OSHA as an agency does not have the resources to enforce a vaccination mandate governing all companies of over 100 employees. It's an enormous number of companies. They're not going to go and do spot checks or inspections or things of that sort. It's just impractical. So OSHA would be relying primarily on one of two things, either whistleblowers, employees within the company who report to OSHA that they feel unsafe because they think the company is not carrying out the measures that it is required to carry out to protect their safety, including vaccination, and incidences of actual COVID-19 infection outbreaks in particular places. So if OSHA becomes aware that there's a company that's had a large outbreak, they'll figure out pretty quickly that it's likely that there are unvaccinated people in that workforce. And those would be the mechanisms that OSHA would use. Outside of that, you know, it's really not something that it's not something that OSHA has the ability to enforce as society-wide. It's a matter of companies complying because, you know, they're trying to obey the law or comply with what has been passed down to them as good practice. And it's very similar with CMS. There are an enormous number of Medicare and Medicaid recipients. They are required, or CMS is requiring them to provide some data about their vaccination rates. So that's a bit more forward than what OSHA is doing. But again, if an institution is not complying, then CMS is going to rely on people within the institution or on news of outbreaks happening or things happening that bring it to their attention that the vaccination rates in that place are not up to what they're supposed to be.
Well, what are the consequences of not complying with either OSHA or CMS mandates?
That is another significant distinction between them. OSHA mandates, if the company is found to be non-compliant, OSHA has the power to fine them. The fine is about $13,000 per instance and can be multiplied by 10 for a willful disregarding of this requirement, which can, for a company with a large number of employees who are unvaccinated, theoretically add up to a very large amount of money. Although, again, it's not known how OSHA will initially respond to potential breaches of compliance. They very often, OSHA, when it deals with a company that is in breach of some other OSHA requirement, whether it's how the wiring is insulated or whether they have scaffolding to prevent workers from falling to high places, the company will initially get a warning and then have an opportunity to cure that defect and then possibly have a smaller fine before OSHA uses its full authority to implement fines. And the same thing is foreseeable with respect to an OSHA vaccination mandate. If you have a company that has a relatively minor lapse that is making some effort to conform with it, but is falling short in some aspect, OSHA might just say, well, we're going to issue a warning. And if there is an injury that occurs or something comes of that, might issue a small fine before going to the full $13,000 per incident fine. CMS is very different in that CMS is providing the Medicare and Medicaid dollars to hospitals. And the penalty that would be imposed for violation of that mandate would be that CMS would deny those funds to that institution. And it, depending on the institution, that can be an enormous percentage of their income. It could be 30 or 40% of the revenue of a given hospital may be Medicare and Medicaid funds. So that is substantial. And that is also something, you know, I don't think that's something that weighs in the consideration of the court in deciding whether these mandates go forward. The court did seem more favorable towards the CMS mandate because it's the government deciding how to spend its money.
With regards to the mandates and the hearings, can they be modified at any point? Or let's say, like, questions arose, can they... The folks that are putting these mandates together, can they change them up, or would they have to go back to the drawing board and then come out and bring them again?
That is a good question, and it's also something of an unknown. This regulatory back and forth between the courts and the agencies is like a waltz, and it's a waltz that we have seen danced before. There have been numerous instances where an agency has come out with a rule. Aspects of that rule have been challenged in court and found to be improper, unsupported by their statutory authority, or untenable for some other reason. And then the agency has gone back to the drawing board and issued a new or different rule that conforms with what the court has said and is therefore able to go forward. And that is a possibility with respect to both of these mandates. It depends on the reasoning of the court. If the court does stay one of the mandates or either of the mandates, if the court does that because there is some specific deficiency in the way the mandate is structured. One of the issues that came up, for example, with respect to the CMS mandate was that CMS oversees a lot of different kinds of medical providers. There are hospitals, there are long-term care centers, there are ambulatory care centers, and each one has a statute or statutory language which says this is how CMS can oversee the operations of this kind of entity with respect to determining whether they will receive these funds. And some of these have language saying that CMS can ensure the health and safety of patients being treated in these places. And a few of them don't have that kind of language. And it was brought up before the court, Justice Barrett noted, about 97% of entities falling under the CMS mandate do have this kind of language, but it's questionable for the 3% that don't, whether they actually are under the authority of the CMS to say we're going to impose a vaccination mandate. So if the court decides that CMS can only impose such a mandate where they have a statute that specifically says, for example, with respect to long-term care centers, that Medicare and Medicaid dollars can only be given to places that are ensuring the health and safety of their patients, then CMS may have the authority to impose the mandate there and not for kinds of places that don't have that kind of language. And that might be a restriction that the court says we're going to put on this statute or we're going to put on this regulation. We are going to stay its operation with respect to those entities that don't have that kind of language. The OSHA mandate is a bit different. The issues really are with the size of the businesses that are being imposed with this regulation. And if the court does anything that's sort of a partial measure and says we're going to stay it with respect to some kind of business, it may be, for example, with respect to businesses that have over 100 employees but don't have over 100 employees working in a particular facility. I think that's somewhat less likely, but it's certainly not outside the realm of possibility or not outside the realm of the history of what courts have done in shaping stays of regulations in the past.
We have about 2 minutes before break. What kind of timeline is the Supreme Court on? Do we know when the next thing is supposed to come up?
That is interesting because the justices asked during the proceedings whether the litigants thought that there should be an administrative stay while the court decides the matter. I frankly would have expected the court to have come out very quickly with a determination on a stay. I was anticipating that it would come out yesterday, and it did not. And the fact that it didn't also speaks a bit to the care and concern that the court is taking in deciding this matter. They did not provide an administrative stay, so they're not concerned with the fact that these mandates technically are going forward while they contemplate the question of the stay. And it may be a few more days or a week before they actually come down with a decision on that. There's no precedent, again, for determining how long the court should take to institute a stay. That's something that, you know, is normally not done through this kind of proceeding. But clearly, the justices are going to be writing extensively on it. There are going to be multiple opinions. There are going to be people who agree and disagree. And they're probably going through sort of a negotiating process where they go back and forth deciding what these opinions are going to say and who's going to join which opinion.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us, Brian. We'll definitely keep in touch and see where this leads. Real quick, are you thinking this might come out one way or the other? Do you have any sort of feeling towards this?
My gut instinct is that the OSHA mandate will be stayed and that the CMS mandate will be allowed to go forward, but may be curtailed in some respects.
All right. We'll wait and see what happens. Brian Dean Abramson is an adjunct professor of vaccine law at Florida International University College of Law. We'll be back after a quick break, and we'll come back and learn about the potential for toxic algae blooms in Indiana's water and the impact it could have if it gets into drinking water. If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobel. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're talking now about the impact of toxic algae blooms in water around the state. We'll find out about the health effects it might have and what it might cost Hoosiers to keep their drinking water clean. With us now is Rebecca Thiel, energy and environment reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Rebecca, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Let's get into this algae. What is blue-green algae?
So believe it or not, it's not algae at all. It's little microscopic organisms that can look like algae when they're all together, also known as a bloom.
Oh, that's interesting, because I was thinking, wasn't algae supposed to be something that you can drink, or is that something else?
Right. Yeah, there is algae that you can actually drink that I think is in some juices and things like that. But yeah, it's actually not algae. They're organisms. And of course, the problem is that those organisms can produce chemicals. And some of those might make the water taste or smell funny, but some are toxic to humans and aquatic life.
And what makes it toxic?
You know, basically, you know, I don't know all the scientific ins and outs, but, you know, some of those chemicals are just simply when they get into high enough concentrations, they can be harmful. And, you know, I should also say that if you're looking at something like a lake, from a fish standpoint, blue-green algae can also use up all the oxygen in the water. It can block sunlight and clog the gills of fish as well.
Is that when you see, like, if you're out by a lake or a place with water, and there's just like piles of sort of greenish floating blobs on top? Would that be it?
You know, it's really hard to say because it could be actual algae. Mm. So, you know, really, you would look for that, I think, that blue-green color. But that's something that probably you would want to test to see if that was blue-green algae or just algae.
Right, right. Well, who should be worried about algae problems in their drinking water? I'm going to assume most of us should be concerned.
Well, you know, actually, it's mostly people who live in, you know, a big city, and therefore they get their water from a surface drinking water source. So that's something like a lake, a river, or a reservoir.
Okay, well, and is there stuff being done? I mean, I'm just thinking, like, if the water sources are from there and they're likely to get these blooms, I guess what's the outcome?
Well, you know, most cities do fortunately treat the water. So some of that algae does get sort of filtered out. But there are a lot of different treatments and things. Did you want me to go through that?
Sure.
So when I talked with folks for the story in Bloomington, for example, they use something called activated carbon, which is what you might find in your home pitcher water filter. They just use it on a larger scale. Some cities use UV radiation to try to get out some of those chemicals. Some use ozone. And then there are also some things that cities can do in terms of monitoring and prevention. So the city of Toledo, for example, has sensors out on Lake Erie where they can actually detect blue-green algae and see that it's forming, and so they'll know when to best add those treatments.
Oh, that's interesting. And when it comes to this problem with these algae blooms and such, is this something that we're recently seeing, like an uptick, or has it always been around?
So this is definitely not a new problem. Anytime you mix warm, stagnant water with too many nutrients from things like fertilizer or sewage or erosion, you're going to get algae blooms. The reason that this is now something that is becoming more of a problem is because climate change is creating basically the perfect storm of those two mixes. Our waterways are warmer for longer, and we're getting more heavy rains washing those nutrients into our lakes and rivers. So that means that we're more likely that it's more likely that we're going to get an algae bloom and that those blooms will stick around for a longer period of time.
What kind of health effects could we see if people ingest this toxic algae?
Well, you know, as I said, there are all of these different kinds of chemicals that can be produced from blue-green algae. So there's a really wide variety of what those health effects are, too. So, you know, it could be like a stomach bug. You could get nausea, diarrhea. But other types of algae can have long-term effects like kidney and liver damage. Some of those chemicals are neurotoxins. They can cause seizures. And that's really why it's important for utilities to know what's in our water.
Yeah, I feel like I've seen in some places where you can swim in lakes and stuff, they'll have a notice if there's like a lot of an algae bloom just to warn people not to get in the water.
Sure. Yeah. If you get in the water and there's an algae bloom, you can also have basically like a rash. And if you inhale it, I believe there are some bad effects there as well. Dogs can also get sick from algae blooms in the water. So those are all things to consider and why those beach alert notifications are important.
Well, if you're listening and have any questions or comments, you can reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana or leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. Once again, that number is 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Rebecca Thiel, Energy and Environment Reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, about toxic algae blooms in water around the state. Rebecca, what are some of the ways that water utilities are trying to combat this problem? I know you mentioned some of the solutions, but is there anything else?
There really is an array of things that utilities are doing to combat it. As I said, you know, the treatment. So basically, when we finally find those toxins in the water, treating those and making sure those chemicals don't make it up into the final product with what gets into your tap, monitoring. And then there's also, you know, a lot of them are trying to find out ways where the nutrients can basically try to stop the nutrients from getting into the water in the first place.
Is it costly to clean polluted water on a big scale for these utility companies?
It definitely can be. And there's a wide range of those costs as well. So in Bloomington, for example, with that activated carbon, that's kind of a lower cost. That's about $100,000 a year for the city. In Toledo, they have a lot of different capital projects to really combat that problem. And they had a capital project of about $500 million. So that can get pretty pricey for cities, and that gets passed on to customers.
Right. And so if the cost gets passed on to customers and do you think if there are more people in the area, it can get divided up? So, for example, in a place like Bloomington, it wouldn't be as expensive as somewhere else where maybe it's a more rural, spread out area?
Sure. And that definitely can be the case. However, we do know that most small communities in Indiana have well water. So, you know, if the question is, who is this really affecting? It's probably people who live in big cities who are lower income. And sometimes that can also be disproportionately people of color. Water bills have grown so much in the past decade in the U.S. that it's really become a big burden for people who are already struggling to pay their bills. You know, that's mostly because we're starting to replace all of this crumbling infrastructure around the country. You know, we've talked about that a lot with the infrastructure bill. I think Ed Moore, the director of public utilities for the city of Toledo, did a really good job of explaining this.
We can go to the state and get grants for road projects to the tune of 80-90%. They'll pay for it. And I know there's a highway tax and all that stuff associated with it. But if I do a water or sewer project, that the cost of that entire project is passed on to the ratepayer. There is no government subsidy for that.
I didn't even realize that.
Yeah. So if you think about that, think about if you personally were responsible for paying for part of that cost of a road, you know, if that was added to your plate. So that can really, that can have a big effect on people who are lower income.
Well, what does this problem tell us about the way we pay for water infrastructure in the U.S.?
I think it really suggests that, you know, like with the road funding, maybe it might need to be more of a taxpayer paid expense rather than something that ratepayers pay for. And this is something that, you know, as I said, we're already seeing somewhat with the federal infrastructure law, right? The Biden administration is putting federal money towards replacing lead pipes and things like that. Though some folks say it's not quite enough to address the huge, huge infrastructure problem that we have in the United States. I think the real question is, going forward, how are we going to maintain that infrastructure in a way that doesn't overly burden lower-income communities? A lot of activists I talk to say clean water is a human right. I think that we all would probably agree with that. But we're really not treating it that way in the U.S. with the way we're funding some of these projects.
I'm still thinking back to what you mentioned, how the cities and more populated areas are the ones that are dealing most with the toxic algae. And I never would have really considered that, because I'm imagining a big city has all of the resources to clean the water, to do all sorts of things. And so, I mean, is that what you're seeing mostly in the reporting that you've done, that big cities are the focus, like Indianapolis, Fort Wayne?
Big cities are more the focus because they use those surface drinking water sources. So they have the problem in general. In smaller communities, they tend to use water sources like well water. And, you know, big cities need those surface drinking water sources because they simply have more people. You know, I'm sure that there are some parts of bigger cities in Indiana that do have aquifers or well water in some way, but you know, to really serve that whole population, you need something like a reservoir.
But my understanding is that the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, doesn't require utilities to test for or remove toxic algae in drinking water. Do you know if there are any changes being worked on that would protect people from the toxic algae?
So the EPA is working on a strategic plan for how to address algae that's due in April of 2023. Though in a statement that the EPA put out when they announced that they would be working on this, they said that a lot of states haven't adopted some of its limits that it has out already for nutrients in water. So there's a lot to be done at the state level, too.
And are you seeing that in the reporting that you've done, that the state is on board with kind of taking some of these tasks on?
I'm not as familiar, I'll be honest, with what the state, with what the Indiana Department of Environmental Management is doing. But one thing that I would point out is that the EPA OIG, the Office of Inspector General, which is the watchdog agency for the EPA, has said that the EPA really needs to take the lead in this matter.
Is it possible for people to test drinking water themselves if they don't want to wait for the utility to possibly do something?
You know, it's an interesting question. I haven't seen a lot of resources for individuals to do that, but I imagine that there are some private labs. Many of them test ponds and, you know, private ponds, things like that, that you probably could get your water tested, your drinking water as well.
What is it that you think or that you've seen that needs to be done in Indiana to prevent more issues like these toxic blooms in the future? I know part of it is just climate change, so I don't know if you can really stop the inevitable.
That's right. So really, you know, with that gone, we really need to focus on the nutrients. And that means, you know, trying to prevent fertilizer, sewage, erosion from getting into our waterways. And people in entire watersheds are going to have to work together in order to do that.
That seems like it might be kind of challenging, especially if there's a lot of agricultural land with runoff going into waterways.
Absolutely. If you take Lake Monroe and Bloomington for an example, everything within that 440 square mile watershed drains into Lake Monroe and becomes the drinking water for Bloomington. That means a lot of those counties, cities, towns, all within that big area are going to have to help. And, you know, that's a lot of stakeholders to work with, and they might not all agree.
Have you heard from any folks on working together and taking this on? Are there any organizations doing that?
Yeah, the Lake Monroe Water Fund is actually, that's specifically what they're working to do, is try to really get these stakeholders together and make it so folks who may not even get their water from Lake Monroe, but their land drains off into that water source, to understand where the water goes and what effect their land management can have.
I wonder how much of this is just over time and history, where we just let things run into the water because we just think the water is going to clean it all away, without realizing that the water is keeping all of the stuff that we're putting in it. And so maybe just some habits have to change.
Sure. And, you know, there are things that you can do, especially if you own property, to reduce algae in waterways. Biggest one is to take care of your septic system. Get it pumped every 3 years. Flush those little septic treatment packs down the toilet every month. If you own land, making sure there's no bare soil around, and planting trees and shrubs along streams. And for farmers, of course, that's planting cover crops. And I think another one is only using fertilizers when you absolutely need to use it. So that might be maybe getting a soil test and seeing, you know, what's in my soil? Do I really need to use this fertilizer on my farm or garden or whatever it happens to be?
And any other tips that you have for folks to, I guess, contribute to reducing algae in waterways? Well, the toxic kind.
I think that I would also encourage people to talk with their water utility and really find out, what are they doing to try to reduce algae in the water? Are they testing for it? And maybe express how important you think that is.
Absolutely. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us, Rebecca. Is there anywhere where we can see some of the work that you've been doing?
Sure. You can go on to IndianaPublicMedia.org or WFYI.org or many of our other member stations, and you can see my work there.
Thank you so much. Rebecca Thiel is the Energy and Environment Reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. We were just talking about toxic algae blooms and what can be done and what is being done in the state. And if you are listening and want to hear more, you can always check out a podcast of this show or any past show. You can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. You can get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. You can always also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soap. Thanks for listening. This is All In.